From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Is Donald Trump a Republican? It's an odd question, because on one hand, of course he is. He won the presidency on the Republican ticket. He's basically the head of the party now. But if you look at many of the president's signature issues, the ones that got him elected, protectionism, his ideas about immigration, a strong executive branch, those aren't actually traditional Republican principles. Or maybe we should say they're not traditional conservative principles. The journalist and political scientist Sarah Jarman is trying to trace the pathway that brought the country from this original concept of conservatism to what it is today. And she says it's not the same, not by a long shot. Jarman will join us today to explain why she thinks the Republican Party is no longer authentically conservative and what that means, of course, for American politics. Join us after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The conversation today is not really about Donald Trump, but in some ways the president is also at the center of what we'll be talking about in this way. Sarah Jarman wants to lay out the pathway that has led us to the rise of Donald Trump and the movement politics that brought him to power. Her book is about conservatism, what she calls authentic conservatism, and how the current Republican Party is not really close to those original ideals, not anymore. In fact, she says in her book, authentic conservatives have no real voice in America right now. Her book is called Elephants on the Rampage, and she's joining us today to talk about it. Sarah Jarman was a journalist whose articles have appeared in The Daily Caller and The Hill, among others. But these days, she's a law student at Brigham Young University's J. Reuben Clark Law School. Her book, as I mentioned, is called Elephants on the Rampage. It's The Eclipse of American Conservatism. She wrote it, I should say, with the late Brent Gilchrist. He was a political philosopher who taught at Brigham Young University and Utah State University. Sarah Jarman is joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. She's going to be in Utah tomorrow for book signings in Provo and Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. But Sarah Jarman, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Okay, so I want to start with Donald Trump, and then we'll move on, because it's something you point out really early on in the book, that though we have to talk about Donald Trump and put him in, you know, in context, it's not the primary topic of the book. But I guess we should say that the emergence of a candidate like Donald Trump is maybe a result of some of the things that you're writing about.
Yeah, I actually started picking up on a trend with the Republican Party that it was moving more towards a movement type of conservatism in 2010. And so I've been kind of piecing this narrative together for quite some time. And Donald Trump is the culmination, essentially, of this trend. And I think it's important to note that while, you know, Donald Trump is kind of the culmination of this, it's important to understand how we got to this point, because Donald Trump will leave office at some point, and understanding how he got here is very crucial.
It's interesting. Let me get this out of the way, too. In a note early in the book, you say you and Professor Gilchrist are neither Republican nor Democrat, neither liberal nor conservative, which is a little hard to believe, but I'll take your point. And you say you adhere to both aspects of those ideologies, which is a way of saying that, look, our book doesn't really have a political agenda. But let me push back a little bit on that.
Right.
Where
okay.
are you guys coming from?
I mean, in various job interviews, actually, on The Hill and when I've just been in political conversations in general, I have for a long time struggled to politically align myself, so to speak, because I find homes in lots of different camps, whether it's libertarian, independent, Democrat. But I appreciate the conservative approach in that I think it is a way to harness those passions that you find in some of the other parties. And so I find that I resonate with certain aspects of different parties, social issues, economic issues. But again, it comes back to kind of how you approach those. And I think that conservatism is a good way to approach those.
Yeah. You said harness passions. And it seems like that's the whole point. And we'll dig into this, but that's your whole – it seems like that is the essence, at least in the way you are thinking about what conservatism is. It's harnessing passions.
Yes, it is. It's harnessing passions. And I'm a very passionate person, as you can ask any of my friends or anyone who knows me. And I think that's the part of conservatism that appeals to me in particular, is because I actually agree with a lot of the things that I hear from commentators or politicians. But I think that the approach that individuals need to take in addressing these very important situations should be more harnessed.
Yeah. So you base the message of your book on what you call knowledge of ancient democratic thought, particularly ideas from Aristotle, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to me, because you say a healthy political community needs an authentically conservative element. But let's start with the ancient democratic thought that you sort of base all of this on.
Mm-hmm. So I studied political philosophy at BYU, and I was particularly drawn to the writings of Aristotle and some of the more recent thinkers, such as Hannah Arendt, who kind of integrate some of those ideas. But essentially the ideas of balance and moderation and this mean that we're supposed to achieve in terms of balancing these passions. And that's the take-home point, essentially, of Aristotle. It's that you have these competing passions and you have to balance them to create this healthy political system. And without that balance, essentially, those passions rule and dominate the political scene.
Authentic conservatism, you argue, could provide an important vitality in American life.
Right.
Explain what you mean, and what you mean by a healthy community needs conservatism, because it sounds like kind of a value statement.
Right.
Explain that. What do you mean?
I mean conservatism in the sense of the political sense.
Right.
I'm not talking about conservatism in the social sense and kind of what we see conservatism being as today. I'm talking about conservatism as in the Aristotelian approach or the moderate approach, that kind of tempered passion, and that without that aspect, essentially communities run awry with the passions of the day.
Yeah. Another essence of your message is that conservatism, which is kind of what you're getting at here, it provides stability.
Yes.
You quote E.J. Dionne, and I wanted to sort of mention this, who said that healthy democracies need conservatism that is suspicious of innovation. So explain what you mean, because it's, in some ways, this is kind of a respect for old things and old habits, but there's a lot of disdain for that. Like, these old guys, what do they know? Let's move on.
Right.
But even E.J. Dionne says it's kind of critical in a system.
Right, it is. I think with the modern era, especially with the technological innovation we have today, a lot of thought isn't given to, wait, what does this technology do? What are we doing with this? You know, and we move so fast with it, we don't really think about what exactly is going on. And you can see that in a lot of the innovation that we have, whether it concerns, reproductive rights and all these other types of things. And I think that without that kind of suspicion, it's not necessarily that we don't engage in innovation. That's not it at all.
Yeah.
Because innovation is a good thing. It's just that we pause. And that's what conservatism is about. It's about pausing, essentially.
Dionne says, you quote him in the book, as saying that another value of conservatism is its suspicion of human nature. And this idea that people can't be molded like plastic to alter their nature. And I guess what you're getting at here, because I've heard you sort of refer to the difference between politics in the social sense and politics in a different sense.
Yes.
And that seems important. So I guess what you're saying is what E.J. Dionne and what you are talking about is you're reacting to some kind of disastrous social experimentation over the years that have led to some pretty bad things.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's the important takeaway for my book, especially. It is about conservatism, but it's also about politics. And conservatism's role in keeping about politics, and conservatism is actually supposed to be more about the procedure aspect of how we govern, not necessarily the content. So the social aspects. And I think it's crucial that we distinguish between those two, because the procedure and the content, the social issues, have been so interwoven together that it's hard to distinguish both the how we govern and what we're governing.
Yeah. So another important point you make is that the Republican Party, at least as it's currently constructed, isn't really conservative, not in the authentic way.
Yeah.
Explain that. And again, we'll dig down on this a little bit later, but give me the broad sense of what you – like, how do you identify the Republican Party then?
I would say – I mean, the Republican Party at points in history has been, you know, more or less conservative, authentically conservative, I guess you could say. But, I mean, currently it's not – I mean, the Republican Party has become more about kind of like an ideological litmus test. Especially with the election of Donald Trump, we've seen a lot of politicians say, well, you just need to get behind him because he's Republican, quote unquote. You know, it's not about being conservative anymore. It's about, well, are you with the party line? And so as we've kind of seen this transition happen, the two have become even farther separated than they were before. And I think you could safely call the Trump presidency anything but moderate and thoughtful. So I would say that those aspects of conservatism have sadly been lost, and many people are looking for a place to go, and they can't find it.
You referred to Hannah Arendt earlier, who seems to have been influential on the way you're thinking about all of this. And she's written about kind of the good part of politics. Politics is being a good thing. It's such a pejorative these days. When you think about politics, that's so political, and that's politically incorrect, you know, correct. And but you're thinking of, but talk about what you mean, what your sense and Hannah Arendt's sense of what politics is.
Politics is essentially a place where we come together and we govern ourselves. And without this governance structure that we set up, we're essentially left with chaos and anarchy. And while politics is a pejorative term, especially right now, people need to remember, and then she talks about this quite a bit in her essays and the books that she's written, that it is the structure of society. Without political governance, without these structures, essentially we don't have community. And it's essential that people remember that politics and community go hand in hand, and without politics, we're left as just kind of solo individuals.
What do you mean when you write in the book that we have debased politics by consuming it with social matters?
It kind of touches on what I was discussing earlier when I was talking about how social issues have come to overrun the political. The political in ancient Greece and kind of in times past was more about sort of addressing larger issues such as, you know, what is the purpose of life, what's truth, et cetera.
Yeah.
And while we necessarily can't address those, you know, and very directly in today's current society, those types of ideas have been essentially lost in the political context today. And instead, the political society we live in is more administrative in nature. And you see this with the rise of agencies, and it's become more about governing the small, tiny details and regulations of life rather than it being more of a place where we can address like general universal concepts such as why are we doing this or what is the purpose of, you know, governance, et cetera.
Public virtue is important to you. It seems like that's what you're getting at. Is
it
morality?
It's
is it a moral thing?
No, because, you know, government shouldn't – I'm a huge proponent of this. Government shouldn't be the one that addresses the issue of morality in the sense of that it creates these codes of conduct whereby, you know, we do certain things because they're, quote, moral. Mm-hmm. But I think that government is essential for it to create the system wherein one can be moral. And – in that sense, it's hugely important. And without the structure that we live in, well, it's just difficult to be moral or to create a sort of a civic virtue.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I think a lot of people, if you would say that abortion is a moral issue, that same-sex marriage is a moral issue, that transgender rights and, you know, these bathroom bills that you're seeing, that these are all conservative values.
Right.
What's the difference? That's the perception these days, right?
Yeah. And they're not. They frankly aren't. And it's really upsetting to me, actually, that they've become sort of the synonymous with conservative values. Because if you look back in the history of the Republican Party, in fact, politicians of during the time of the 50s and the 60s, such as Goldwater, actually lamented the rise of the Christian right and kind of that melding with the Republican Party.
Hold on, because I want to read something. Uh-huh. This caught my eye too. You mentioned Barry Goldwater, and we'll work our way back to Barry Goldwater. But while we're here, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. You say for Barry Goldwater, the essential element of his philosophy was freedom, but he didn't believe religion or moral values were properly political issues. And he said, here's what he says, and he's pretty adamant here. He says, from where do these people presume to claim the right to dictate their moral beliefs for me? I am warning them today that I will fight them every step of the way if they try to dictate their moral convictions to all Americans in the name of conservatism.
Yes.
He lost that battle, it seems, don't you think?
Yeah, he definitely lost that battle. And unfortunately, conservatism did react to a lot of the progressivism in the 50s and 60s and 70s with their own form of movement, as I illustrate later on. But yes, he definitely lost that. And I think it's sad that there aren't very many factions or groups that really espouse that type of conservatism anymore.
Let me read one more quote from Goldwater while we're here. He said, "Mark my word, if and when these preachers get control of the Republican Party, it's going to be a terrible damn problem."
Yeah, it is. And I don't think people really anticipated what kind of a problem it would be, because when you integrate it's not just the Christian right, it's other social issues. Because once you start adopting kind of social causes, it's easier to adopt whatever social cause kind of comes next.
But Sarah, how do you describe the appeal of the Republican Party to, let's just put it in the context of Utah, which of course is predominantly LDS.
Right.
Aren't a lot of Mormon voters, for example, who align themselves with conservatism, quote unquote, or how they see it, and often the Republican Party, whether they call themselves Republicans, they generally call themselves independents and vote Republican, but they align themselves with quote unquote conservatism. And isn't a lot of that because of the moral issues that we were talking about before that Barry Goldwater didn't think belonged in the Republican Party?
Right. And I would actually say it's with the older generation of Republicans. It's really interesting to see the dichotomy between the older generations of Republicans I talk to and the millennials that I frequently associate with, because I would argue my peers don't take that stance as nearly as much as kind of our predecessors. And yet they grew up during the 50s, 60s and 70s during that time, you know. And so I would actually argue that you will see a huge shift in terms of the people who do stay or become Republican. And we've seen that kind of in such as the centrist party that was just recently formed.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. We'll come back to that.
Okay, but yeah, and so...
Will that be appealing to millennials, you think?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
More than the Democratic Party?
I think so, yeah.
Here's what interests me. Like,
okay.
So think about the typical millennial at BYU. Right.
Right.
Who was raised, I don't want to sort of overgeneralize, but I think it would be fair to say that a good high percentage of them were raised by fairly conservative, quote unquote, parents. And they align in some ways with their sort of the party of their parents, but they're starting to disconnect a little bit. So where are they? They have a different kind of moral circumstance. They feel certain ways about abortion, for example, and same-sex marriage. So where are they going to end up, are you seeing?
I would say that the millennials, at least that I know, I mean, and they're of all walks of life.
Of course.
You know, they actually do separate a lot of their religious values with their political values. And I would say that that's becoming more of a trend, especially as, you know, I don't know, as society, I don't want to say progresses, but as society changes. And I think in order to adapt, you're going to have to kind of use more of a libertarian type of conservatism, the type of conservatism that I see my millennial counterparts adapting. Because we do live in a world where there are a lot of different social ideas, I guess you could say, about whether it's gay rights or abortion. And in order to adapt and function in that world, you have to sort of develop this weird kind of separation between your political views and your social views.
Sarah Jarman is with us. Her book is called Elephants on the Rampage. She co-wrote it with the late Brent Gilchrist. Tomorrow night at 5 o'clock, she's going to be at Pioneer Book in Provo. And then later on, she's going to be driving up here to Salt Lake City. She's going to be at Weller Bookworks. And for details about all of those signings, you can go to our website, radiowest.org. We need to take a break, but we'll come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking what happened to the Republican Party, or better, what happened to conservatism, which is a question the journalist Sarah Jarman has been working over. In a new book, she wonders how a party based on conservative ideals like limited government and free markets, how that could have been made over as a populist national movement that she sees today. The book that we're talking about, co-written with Brent Gilchrist, the late Brent Gilchrist, is called Elephants on the Rampage, The Eclipse of American Conservatism. She's going to be in Utah tomorrow, has a couple of book signings. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. She's joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. I want to back up and talk a little bit more about kind of the origins of conservatism as a philosophy. Okay. Because you write about Edmund Burke.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Burke's views of conservatism. And it's interesting, he kind of used a disaster that he was seeing as a platform to create this theory. It was the French Revolution, which had these noble ideals. It seemed like a perfect idea, and then it just disintegrated into chaos. And he was arguing against the excesses of that. And that's how he uses to develop his philosophy, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting. The French Revolution at the time was actually supposed to be, it was supposed to be this kind of overthrow of the aristocracy, and supposed to be this grand thing. And I think it's actually really important, especially now, to look at the French Revolution and kind of observe how passions, as we've talked about, can overrule sort of rationality to the point of sort of the abandonment of conservative ideals, such as temperance and this patience that Burke was advocating. And he started advocating those ideals when he saw sort of Robespierre, the quasi-dictator of sorts, at the time when he started instigating all these morality types of laws and all these really strict rules about how the Parisians should govern themselves. And he was sort of puzzled, and in his kind of, you know, introspection, he realized that what was lacking was this sort of this pacing or temperance, this conservatism. And that's sort of where a lot of people argue conservatism was born, was in reaction to that.
You write that conservatism came into being as this anti-ideology.
Yes.
And that Burke believed any ideology that was supposed to change society was just going against human nature. That you create this ideology, and it doesn't really fit with the way humans naturally behave?
Yeah, well, not humans. It essentially undermines our individuality and our ability, our free agency. ideologies are often governed by people at the top. I mean, my family lived in Russia and Germany, and I studied a lot about Nazism and Stalinism. And the thing that I kept coming back to with both ideologies, which are very different, actually, was that there was someone always at the top running the show.
Yeah.
And this idea that everyone had rights was sort of a misnomer. And when you get into ideologies, essentially what you're doing is subjecting yourself to somebody else's idea of what the good should be.
Burke argued, you say in your book, that in the heat of ideological passion, people will support things they normally wouldn't support. I guess that gets at the kind of the Nazi principle and even the Stalin principle. You do some pretty atrocious things because you get caught up in the ideology, I guess.
Right. And I think it's hard sometimes in current society to equate our circumstances as they were, because they were so grotesque, especially in the 1940s with Stalin and Hitler.
Yeah.
But it's important to remember that they got to those points actually over the course of several decades. It wasn't just one day they woke up and passions overruled them and, you know, they're putting people in concentration camps. It's a gradual process, but at the same time, the results happen very fast. And I think it's important to remember that in terms of, you know, the marches we see, the protests and all of these things, while they have their purpose and point, in excess can lead to a lack of temperance.
And Burke is saying conservatism is be patient, you guys. Don't overreact. We need to impose reason on all of this passion. And that's the essence of conservatism, as he saw it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's harnessing those passions and sort of really, it's about essentially thinking before you speak, I would say.
This was interesting. You write that in the book that ideology had always been a bad word in America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Until like the 1950s. Explain that.
Yeah. So it's interesting. When we look back in terms of like the 50s and 60s, the Soviets were often described in that context, like they're ideological, you know. And that was a bad word. Yeah. And that was what America wasn't, right? But it's interesting because ideology has come to dominate a lot of the political scene currently. And I think unbeknownst to many, well, perhaps that word isn't thrown around quite so regularly, the types of behaviors I think that the political parties engage in now are actually more ideological than not.
Yeah. Well, and this gets to, it seems like another really important point, is that conservatism in its purest sense, or certainly in its most authentic sense, isn't a movement. It's supposed to be a counter to a movement.
Yes, it is. It's not a doctrine. It's not a list of things that you need to do. Like I said, it's not a litmus test. And we've made it a litmus test when it's, as I've said before, it's a procedure. It's a way of looking at things, not necessarily a set of rules in a contract that you would see, for example, with the Marxists in the Soviet Union or other groups where they have to abide by these certain codes of conduct.
So that makes me wonder, is conservatism, should it be properly aligned with any political party? Right now, of course, it's connected to the Republican Party. Does it even belong in a political party? It seems like in some ways, if it's applied properly, it should belong outside of the political process.
Well, it should be. And for a time, the Republican Party did espouse a lot of those virtues. And it correctly was assigned sort of the Republican name. But I would argue that if the Republican Party isn't able to sort of carry that torch anymore, that it should be given to another entity and another party should sort of take that mantle up.
When does it start to get aligned first with the Republican Party? Because one of the things, we have to even back up further.
Right.
Because you mentioned there are these business elements within the party. And then the mainstream of the Republican Party figured they needed more movement-oriented reformers and radicals to join them. And this was when they elected Abraham Lincoln. So this goes way back.
Yeah, no, it does. And a lot of, you know, people that the party's known for being about freedom, actually. And it was sort of it encompasses sort of the general principles that I've talked about. And it wasn't ideologically oriented at all. There wasn't, you know, there weren't the equivalent of the Christian right joining the Republican Party during the Lincoln era. It was really about some of those principles that I've talked about.
Who's Russell Kirk? You've read about him. He seems like an interesting figure. He emerges in the 50s?
Yeah, in the 50s. He was the one who attributed Edmund Burke essentially as being the founder of conservatism. And sort of discusses this temperate approach that conservatism offers, and approaches it more as sort of a structure or a means of looking at politics rather than a social kind of idea.
And he hated the idea of turning conservatism into an ideology.
Yes, he very much did. I think a lot of the individuals during that era, as you've seen, like with Buckley and Kirk, started to see some of the writing on the wall. And in terms of it becoming an ideology and becoming it more about social issues, and unfortunately, that's exactly what happened.
What would Russell Kirk make of Donald Trump and the Republican Party today, do you think? I mean, if you look at the way he thought about resisting ideology and conservatism, what would he make of the party today?
Well, I would actually argue that he would say that, I mean, it's kind of gone through its ideological seasons and cycles of the Republican Party, but Donald Trump is even beyond ideology. He's a populist. He doesn't have an ideology actually himself, but rather I think he would argue that he's sort of the culmination of the Christian right's involvement in politics and sort of making the Republican Party more about those movement or populist ideas.
Wait, that's interesting. So Donald Trump does they've gotten so far from the idea of conservatism that you now have someone who doesn't represent anything in terms of ideology.
No, and it's really interesting. And I'm not trying to make some huge, broad, sweeping sentiment or statement. But when you get beyond the point of, let's say, it sort of kind of goes independent thinking ideology, and then the next step after that is sort of this anarchy or chaos, sort of this populist type of thinking. He kind of represents that, and it's kind of a sad point to be at, actually.
Eisenhower's interesting. You write about him. You say that over time, the Republican Party kind of started to strip out these diverse voices and that they didn't really end up having much of a choice. Where did Eisenhower fit in all of this? Because you talk about how he was guided by a kind of moderate conservatism blended with these touches of liberalism. He used to take advice from liberals. He would listen to different perspectives. Where does he fit in this story?
I would actually say that I don't necessarily think he's per se the ideal, but he really spoke to sort of the average American, just your day-to-day American. And, he, as I kind of talk about in the book, he was kind of perceived as this grandfather type of figure.
Yeah.
And he really kind of, but he was also one of the people who sort of transitioned also, I think, the Republican Party more to a kind of a progressive approach, whether, he realized he was doing that or not as social issues started to get involved later on.
Yeah.
And honestly, as I was writing this book, I came back to the question over and over again of what, is there such thing as a truly conservative president?
Yeah.
Because I found aspects of conservatism, but ultimately presidents they have to govern social issues also. They're not political philosophers. They don't just sit in clouds and think about things all day. But I think it's about applying kind of that balance between the two that I think we lack. And you've kind of seen the I guess, regression of the political philosophy aspect of things and more of the social overwhelming that.
This may surprise some people. You write that Ronald Reagan actually rejected conservative views of history
yeah.
and progress.
I love Reagan as much as the next person.
I know, and he is seen as the icon of conservatism.
Right.
But what you're saying is he didn't really fit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a travesty for me to say some of the things I say in this book because I trounce upon, I guess, the conservative idea of you know, and Republicans, and they're supposed to be conservative and, you know, all these things. But if you really look at Reagan, he wasn't very conservative. I mean, the debt increased tremendously under Reagan. He was very social in terms of, he implemented a lot of social policies. He was kind of a neocon in his own right, with Star Wars and all of these things. And I'm just going through the policies that he sort of enacted during that era. It's the farthest thing you would see in terms of a conservative. I love Reagan though. But he's not sort of the epitome or the ideal of what a conservative is if you're looking at it from a Burkean sort of perspective.
Yeah. I want to get back to Goldwater because he emerges. It seems like in some ways is a kind of a reaction to the Eisenhower era. And you have William F. Buckley as kind of one
yeah.
of the key leaders of this new right. And you talk about Buckley's magazine, which most people know, National Review.
Yeah.
And it becomes the voice of, as you put it, this deliberately rootless kind of conservatism, connected instead to liberalism as its enemy. Is this when conservatism then starts to emerge as the counter to quote-unquote liberalism?
Yeah, that's essentially the point I argue is the 50s and the 60s was essentially when conservatism did emerge as the counter or the opposite of liberalism or progressivism or the Democrats. And it's fairly sad in some respects because conservatism, as you've kind of mentioned earlier, should be more outside of the political realm. And I think because the Republicans sort of claimed conservatism and kind of took it as their own, it actually prevented the liberals or Democrats from also sort of adopting conservative ideals in their own right. And I think that's when you started to see this polarization that we see now.
This question of populism comes up,
mm-hmm.
where it fits in the scheme of things. Let me take a call.
Right.
There's a question from John in Salt Lake that may get us to this idea of what populism is. John, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Doug, thank you. I just wanted to take exception with the referral of Trump as a true populist. You know, populism refers to the expressing the will of ordinary people. And I would describe Trump as a reactionary figure to a reactionary public. If you think of populism as progressivism in the early 1900s, very little of what Trump has espoused represents the concerns of the ordinary people. He's been an economic opportunist, taking advantage of the loss of the manufacturing base. But very little about him would be true populism. He's more of a demagogic reactionary figure. And that's my comment.
Yeah, Sarah German, you agree with that, though, don't you, as in terms of a reactionary
yeah.
figure?
No, he is a reactionary figure. I would say that, unfortunately, the media, though, has portrayed, has sort of associated this populism with the ordinary person. And I actually think the definition of what an ordinary person is, especially today, is up for grabs. Who is the ordinary person? He appeals to populist sentiments. Perhaps he isn't a populist himself, but
or was manipulating populists.
Yes, and so I think what you'll see with Trump is he's a skilled businessman. I mean, he's incredible. He knows how. I mean, in a sense, he does know what the people want, and has just a sort of applied his business ability to do that into politics.
There are a few people who might push back on whether he's brilliant in business. No one's seen his tax
right.
returns yet to know. He's
right,
clearly
right,
has a lot
right.
of money, but I get your point.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he, I mean, in the sense of he knows how to play the game, right?
Yeah,
he knows how to get where, yeah.
Right. I don't think anyone would argue with that. That's
yeah. Perhaps he's not Bloomberg, but yeah.
Yeah. So this brings us to the Republican Convention of 1964.
Right.
Where Goldwater, of course, famously says moderation in the protection of liberty is no virtue. Extremism in the defense of freedom is no vice. So he's what? Departing completely, Goldwater, at the time from – he's saying, no, conservatives aren't moderate. We are, in fact – we have to be extreme in our – was this an important moment?
I mean, I think it was in the sense that it started to delineate the conservatives that I've talked about and the ones that we see now. I think from that point on, you did start to see more of a trend towards the Republican Party as the Republican Party and less as, less as that of integrating true conservative principles. And unfortunately, these subtle changes that I've talked about aren't really addressed or marked in history. I mean, you're not going to see, in a history book, 1964, when conservatism died. You know, it's more of a gradual sort of diminishing, I would say.
Sarah Jarman is with us. Her book is Elephants on the Rampage: The Eclipse of American Conservatism. She co-wrote it with Brent Gilchrist. Who died, by the way, last year. She's going to be coming to Utah tomorrow. She's going to be at Pioneer Book in Provo. Also, Weller Book Works in Salt Lake City. For details about the signings, just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Sarah Jarman. We're talking about her book, Elephants on the Rampage. The subtitle of the book really makes her point, The Eclipse of American Conservatism. She's joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. So, Sarah, explain what you mean when you write, Americans have been left without any real alternatives to ideological movement politics. Like, what do you mean? What would an alternative, like, what are the policies that would right. emerge, that would reflect an alternative, that would reflect true conservatism? What would that look like in terms of foreign right. policy? What would that look like in terms of domestic policy?
Well, it's interesting that you should bring that up. Kind of, we've talked about the centrist party that was sort of created in Utah just recently. I think that just reading through some of the ideas that they propose is sort of the closest thing that you could get. And because it's a kind of a, I would say, a true conservative approach. It doesn't matter what per se the agenda is, right? Whether it's a whatever type of issue it is, it's how you approach it. And I would say that it's an ability to combine different aspects of perhaps different parties that we would see, whether libertarian or liberal or. Whatever they might be, and sort of apply the conservative approach in addressing them. It's difficult to sort of put a finger on it, but I would say that an independent sort of party right now, the emergence of something like that is the closest thing that you would get. And because conservatives aren't, ideological in nature, it would be sort of it wouldn't be something put together around contracts, for example, but rather something that perhaps arises organically.
Do these people exist anymore? True conservatives?
I think they do. Yes, I totally think they do. And I, in part, wrote this book and am so passionate about these ideas because I think that they are an underrepresented and unheard class. These are the people who aren't going to necessarily be taken to the streets all the time. They're not heard, right? I mean, the people who speak the loudest are often the ones who are ideologically motivated. They're the ones that they get the most attention because they are sort of so loud. And I think that they do need representation.
They just don't have a forum.
No, there's no forum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing that seems like a big problem.
Right.
It's However it happened, and we've been talking about this for the last hour or so, the Republican Party did align itself with conservatism. And whether it's legit or not, it did. And it's working. I mean, look at Utah. They have the governor's office. They kill it in the legislature.
Right.
Crazy overwhelming majority. Look at both of the Senate seats, of course, all of the congressional delegation, Republicans.
Right.
What's the incentive to make any change?
You know, I think that more of that was in reaction to some people's frustration, actually, with the Obama administration, not necessarily because they agreed with the Republicans. I think right now you have an America that elects people as a means to kick other people out, not necessarily because they believe in, per se, what the party that they voted for believes in. And so,
which could explain Donald Trump in some ways. A lot of that incentive was against Hillary Clinton, probably.
Right. I mean, it's a huge aspect of that. And so that's a problem, though, if you're voting for people simply as kind of a retaliatory tactic. That's very destabilizing. And I think that if you do sort of create a way for these people to organize, which is very difficult, these sort of centrists, these conservative, you know, more authentically conservative people, I think that you could give, you know, more of a voice back to those people, and they could, in the future, I don't think necessarily right now, become more of a solid entity or party.
I want to come back to something we were talking about earlier that seems to kind of underline a lot of the way you've been thinking about this, and it's this idea about public virtue.
Right.
You write this in the book that what passes for politics now is the satisfaction of private desires and the affairs of society rather than the accomplishment of public goods, which are the true matters of true politics. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that. What's the difference between a private desire and the public good? Because that's where you think we should be getting is public good.
Right. Well, and this kind of ties into the idea that I talk about at the end of the book, which is civic charity, which actually President Holland of UVU wrote about in a
Matthew
book
Holland,
in 2007. And it's this idea of brotherhood, right? It's this idea that you care for your neighbor more than yourself. I mean, it's a Christian value, but it has transcended sort of the Christian realm. As I talk about in my book with Jefferson, in that it's these values have been made secular. And without that sort of brotherhood or forgiveness, as I also talk about, for mistakes in the past, for decisions we've made, we won't be able to progress. And that's more important than sort of our private desires that I talk about, that, you know, it's the day to day, you know, of course we need to get through our day and do some of the, you know, the mundane tasks of life. And we need to have, you know, agencies that govern those, but to sort of place those mundane aspects above sort of this greater brotherhood is problematic.
I have to say, I love this idea that one of the remedies for all of this, you say, at least one of the first steps for resolving what you see as this imbalance is forgiveness.
Right.
Explain that, because you mentioned, for example, this thinker, some may know, Jonathan Schell, who talks about that this idea of forgiveness is a remedy for say a little bit more about that, because I think that's really interesting.
So this idea of forgiveness in the sense of it's not just about, you know, forgiving. It's not just about forgiving perhaps ourselves for the decisions we've made, but also like the decisions we've made in terms of electing the leaders we've made or the policies we've implemented. It's as crazy as it might sound to some people, ultimately is about forgiving someone like Donald Trump or perhaps electing someone like Donald Trump or whoever it is that, you know, or policy that perhaps, you know, brought, you know, things about for the worse. And without that ability, without that ability to forgive yourself, your enemies or others just overall, we're continuously kind of stuck in this quagmire of hatred for Donald Trump, as we kind of have seen.
Let me come back to a question I was asking earlier, like what this looks like. What does justice and moderation look like as a matter of governance or policy?
Oh, that's a deep question. Yeah. Moderation. I would say that it's about not only thinking about moderation comes down to just not thinking about the moment, but thinking about what the implications are for the actions that you're engaging in that moment. What does it look like down the road? And if we don't look at some of those implications, then essentially one's not being moderate, but very sort of impatient and not thoughtful. And especially what we've seen now in the first, couple months of this administration is sort of a hastiness to get things done. And for example, in passing the health care bill, whatever you think of the health care bill, that's fine. But sort of this hastiness isn't moderate and it's not just.
Sounds like you. I know that a lot of young people hate the term millennial, but let me just use it as a way of. Do you hate it, by the way?
I kind of do because I think, I do just because I think my generation gets a lot of flack sometimes.
Yeah, no, I hear it. I totally hear it. But it sounds like you're putting a lot, that you don't deserve. But it sounds like you're putting a lot of faith in this younger generation to fix this. Is that right?
Right. I believe in us. Maybe that's, super idealistic of me to think. But I think because we sort of live in a world of contradictions, we have to kind of start from the ground up. And I think you'll see sort of an emergence of more of a centrist or independent type of party because of that. And I know that we're not politically involved currently, but I think you'll start to see more political involvement, especially as the older generation dies out and we'll have to kind of answer for the things that have happened. Hmm.
Sarah Jarman, her book, which she co-wrote with the late Brent Gilchrist, is called Elephants on the Rampage, The Eclipse of American Conservatism. I should point out that she's going to be in Utah tomorrow, back in Utah. She's actually going to school here, but she's in Washington. What, for the summer, I guess?
Yeah, for the summer.
Got it. Okay, she's going to be speaking at Pioneer Book in Provo tomorrow and at Weller Bookworks in Salt Lake City. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Sarah, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. The show directed by Tim Slover, I should also point out. I'm Doug Fabrizio.